Hey, this is Amon Green. You're listening to season two of the Fragging and Lagging podcast.
20-10 touchdown. Roll back that beautiful bean footage and you'll find it.
I can't hear a thing in the game. It's like, hey, there's a friend request. Hey, there's a friend request.
All right, this bastard is on my, okay, GTFO, bitch.
All right, everybody, here it comes. Sit back and enjoy the Fragging and Lagging podcast. Yo, what's going on, everybody? We're back again, and not only are we back, this guy was so good that we couldn't put everything into one episode. We had to have him back for a part two. But before we do anything, thank you guys for all the love and support. Justin, thank you very much. And this is not possible without my co-host, the Beast from Bruise, the homie, the brother from another mother, blah, 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 blah. Joaquin Blaze, how's it going, buddy?
Man, I just, you know, having everybody knows we got Amon Green again, so having Amon Green, you doing the intro, I feel like I'm running up the field and going through a flag, and the flag doesn't break, and I fall down, but you pick me back up, Junk. You're amazing.
Yeah, I'm the hype man. So, but yo, you guys, if you haven't listened to Amon's first episode, shame on you. Go back and listen to it, and then come back to this one, and then go back to that one, and then come back to this one. Do it like 67,000 times. It's fine with me. So, well, we left off with first and foremost, welcome back, Amon. It's a pleasure to have you back, man.
Hey, thanks for having me back. Couldn't wait to do it, and it's just we're like.
How does it feel to be a little bit older than earlier?
feels the same. Still age is a number. Yeah, to me right now.
Knees don't hurt as much, you know, that kind of stuff.
No, so. Knees back is good, so I'm happy.
Being an every down back, you know, I figure, still to this day I can't get over that, man. I was like every down. He was an every down back. And he barely came out the game, played in the league 12 years, correct? 12 years?
Yep, 12 years.
12 years. And you're still able to walk around and do backhand springs and all that kind of good activity stuff.
Yes, I can. Yes, I can.
So where we left off last episode is that, you had a nice little run, but yeah, year 10 in Green Bay, then year 11, you went to Texas for 1 year, right?
Yeah, actually 2 years. So my 10th year was in Houston.
Yeah.
And 10th and 11th year was in Houston. And that was, I'll say it was just basically, it was one of the most biggest learning experiences as an adult. And something that I basically had to learn was, what I experienced, I'll say that, was something I knew possibly that was going to come. Because I say that because playing at Green Bay for 8 years and being in Seattle for 2 years, I kind of had a good idea of what a good NFL organization was like, you know, how it was run, what type of players they picked, and what type of mindset those players, you know, developed into as rookies. And I knew at that time that Green Bay, the way they drafted players and the way the coaches coached us into the professionals that we were on the field, I was like, okay, I haven't heard a whole lot about Houston. I just knew at the time Houston hadn't won a lot of games. So I knew it was going to be a big drop off, but I didn't know how far of a drop off. But it was literally like falling off of the edge of the Grand Canyon into the abyss of nothing, because it was just not a good organization. And they're still not good today because it's between the ownership and the GM leadership that's still learning itself. And it wasn't much there. We had a guy by the name of Rick Smith, and he was the youngest GM at the time. He was 34, 36 years old, somewhere in there, 34, 35, 36. And it showed, right away, I didn't see it, but I just had that gut feeling once I signed that deal. And the way that went down too was kind of, suspicious and flaky and, you know, kind of, it just wasn't right, because my agent at the time, who I believed in, who I trusted, he didn't tell me the full truth of what my, contract options were with Green Bay. And I was basically locked in. It was like one of them gangster movies. I was in a room with no windows, one light on, and my contract. and it, you know, it read.
Here's some bread and water. Go have a nice day.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like crazy. I felt like I was in a mafia movie or one of them, Tom Cruise, Mission Impossible movies. I was like, what is going on? People not talking to me. People coming to me every 30 minutes and knocking on the door, checking in on me with the piece of paper, this 4-page contract that read, you know, it had the legal jargon, the legalese on it. And it basically read 4 years, $24 million. But I'm like, am I good? I'm like, I don't want to leave Green Bay. You know, this was the place where I was able to start my career and then grow. And then, you know, in the community and on the team. So I was like, this is not an easy decision, you know. So I called, you know, a couple of teammates, and I didn't get a hold of them, unfortunately. I called Will Henderson. I called Donald Driver to talk with them, just to bounce things off them. But I didn't get they didn't pick up. So I was just like, darn it, you know. And then my agent tells me that Green Bay, you know, hadn't offered, or their offer, I can't remember exactly, but I think I'm pretty sure it was like he didn't hear nothing from Green Bay. Green Bay hadn't said anything because it was free agency time. And that's why I was there. Obviously, I jumped on a private jet from Denver. I had visited the Broncos the day before, 2 days before, and they flew me from Denver. The Texans flew me from Denver to Houston. And so I thought that was, you know, respect, because they came, you know, that means they really wanted me. I felt that they definitely wanted me and definitely needed me. But yeah, once I got there and officially signed, you know, regardless of the circumstances of why I signed. And it just was, you know, just crazy experience, just because like I said, it started with Rick Smith, the GM, McNair, the owner at the time when he was, when he was here, he was, you know, one leading the decisions, making choices, but between him and Rick and among the players and the coaches, you know, once I got in that locker room and met, you know, guys like Mario Williams, Andre Johnson, some of my old teammates were there from Green Bay. And then, you know, new players like Ephraim Salam, Chester Pitts, trying to think, there's quite a few players, really good players. Some of them Pro Bowl players, some of them that, you know, they're going to go down in Houston Texan history players. So, you know, these are still the one percenters, regardless of how good the team is or isn't. These are the one percenters in football. These are really good football players. It just, the chemistry of the team wasn't there. And I felt that in the first couple, first couple of days of training camp, mini camp practice and off-season conditioning was just like what I experienced in Green Bay. It was a lot of, you know, all the players were there. We were having fun, getting to know each other and things of that nature. But I say once training camp started and the hard work had to, now the hard work is showing up, you know, who's going to work hard, who's going to push each other, who's going to make each other better. You know, that started to show up, or maybe didn't show up. We had a really good training camp to get ready for the season. I was excited because, you know, now this is somewhere where I'm definitely one of the elder statesmen and I could be a leader. And up until that time, I thought I had been a pretty decent leader, you know, throughout my career, you know, in Green Bay, Seattle, and even at Nebraska. I was a team captain my junior and senior year. And it just was interesting. It was just everybody, you know, it was a little different because everybody was kind of on their own thing. They had their own personal stuff going on, or they just had football stuff going on, you know, where they're trying to, you know, become a starter or be a player that is recognizable, but not really working as a team in some ways. And working as a team sometimes is asking the tough questions or telling people, hey man, we got to do this to get better. You got to do your part. I got to do my part. I got to run the ball. I got to hold on to the ball. I got to protect the quarterback. I got to do this. And now you do this. You know, you're not doing this, because in practice I could see, you know, it's calling each other out, but doing it in a professional way and doing it in a respectful way, because that's just, we're doing it to make each other better. And that I didn't feel, you know, that wasn't there, but it wasn't the player. It started with leadership. It was a new coaching staff. Coach Gary Kubiak came in, and it was one of his first, maybe his first time head coaching, maybe his second time. And I could just see he was under a lot of pressure, you know, at the top. And that came from the ownership, that came from the GM, of trying to win right away and trying to put the chemistry and the team players together to do it. And we had the athletes, you know, I had myself. We had Ron Dane also at running back, who was a Heisman Trophy winner out of Wisconsin. He had played on the New York Giants and went to the Super Bowl with Tiki Barber and that team back in the early 2000s, like 2001, 2000. But then you have a guy like Andre Johnson, who is the all-time leading receiver in Houston Texan history. He had Mario Williams, who was a highly touted draft pick out of North Carolina State. And at that time, he was just learning how to become a player. But physically, he was amazing. He was, you know, he was like Megatron or something playing on defense. He was big. He was huge. He was aggressive. He just had to learn. He was young. And that was just like any other NFL player coming, you know, out of college, being a first round draft pick, whatever position. You have to learn certain things to become that constant pro. And later in his career, he did. When he got to, I believe when he went free agent to Buffalo, and he helped bring Buffalo to kind of where they are now, you know, making that defense real tough and respectable. And so you have players like that, that it was just the beginning of their careers, and, you know, or like my career coming to an end, but getting to, but still had a lot of life left. And it was just, but it'll say it was just an up and down thing through the training camp. And once the regular season started, we started pretty good. I remember my first game, that first game of the year, I believe it was against Kansas City. And I'll never forget it because I got a knee injury late in the third quarter. And I came out maybe a series, and but then went back in and finished the game. And at this point in time, I didn't think this was going to be a knee injury that would, you know, hold me out very long or even put me on IR. But it ended up holding me out for like 2 weeks because of the pain. It was, and I found out later that I had a bruised kneecap, and a bruised kneecap is nothing to mess with. It is, it's sore. It's painful. Yeah, I say it
sounds already painful, man.
Yeah. Damn. On a scale of 1 to 10, it's probably a 20. It is bad. And so, you know, being the circumstances that they are, you know, I was a new player to the team. I was a franchise running back that just signed a big deal. So all the pressure got put on me to come back and play. And my body was telling me otherwise. My body was like, and I listened to my body all the time. No matter how many years I played in the NFL, that was one reason I did, because I listened to my body. And my body was telling me I can't go no more. So after the 2 weeks I was out, came back for 2 weeks, and it just wasn't, it was just more pain. Every time I got nicked on my knee or fell on my knee, it was just irritating, and it would just swell up every time. And so I told him, like, look, I can't play on this until it gets better. And I found, you know, a doctor by the name of Dr. Andrews. He was a most renowned ACL doctor out of Birmingham, Alabama. I went to see him, and he MRI'd it. He CAT scanned it, and he basically said it wasn't nothing structural, like terrible about your knee, but he just see the bruising of the kneecap and the bone behind the kneecap. And then said that, you know, the biggest thing you got to do is rest it. The more you run on it, the more it gets hit, then the more swelling you're going to have. It's never going to be right. And the swelling is pushing on the joints and the ligaments that are in the knee area. And I'm like, okay. And so I went back to Houston, told Houston, you know, the trainers, told Rick Smith, told Kubiak that. And, you know, then, you know, they were, this never gave me a straight answer, but then eventually they just made the decision, put me on IR. And I was like, okay, I'd never been on IR. We had more than half the season.
What as a European, what is IR?
Injury reserve. So, and I'd never been on it, and we had more than half the season left. So I thought, you know what, I can heal up and be back by December. And then we're talking about late October, early November. I said, if they just give me a month off, in my head, I could be back. And I told him that actually, and I actually told Rick Smith that, and the training staff that, and then the next day they put me on IR. I was like, oh, okay, I guess they didn't want to take my my information that I know my body, and if I just heal for a month, I could be ready. So obviously they didn't believe me. They put me on IR, and then now I'm sitting on IR, and this is like dumbfounded because I've never been there, and I knew it wasn't nothing. I knew I could bounce back from that. My body always healed up good when I needed, if I got the proper rest and recovery, you know, massage, you know, if it was getting treatment, ice bags and all that stuff, and massages, everything. And all that I used to help my body heal up after every injury, after every game. And it just, you know, they, like I said, it was just interesting that they did not believe me that I could, you know, come back after a month if I didn't come back after 2 weeks. So I was like, all right. So I was on IR. I say, but something I haven't added into that is what, so with all this going on, you know, you see, I'm already kind of setting the stage for what you see is going on as just me coming in as a player. I got all these different things. I'm hurt now. I'm in a new city. I got a GM that's a little bit different. You know, he's young, he's learning. But then on top of that, my dad at the time was in terminal cancer with terminal liver cancer. And he was living in he was living in the Wisconsin area with my mom, and they decided to move, which I knew at the time wasn't a good idea because he was so sick. But they pushed we want to move down to Houston and be next to you. And Marie at that time was my fiance, my soon to be wife. And I was like, no, because dad is really sick. It's better to stay. He stays there with his doctors that are taking care of him. You know, we got to come down here. If you come down here, we got to find a doctor. We got to get you guys set up in your own living space. And that would just be too much. But they just kept pushing and end up moving. And then, so I had that going on. So I'm in a new city. My family's adjusting. My kids are adjusting. And then my mom and dad, now my dad's adjusting to a new doctor and, you know, dealing with liver cancer and all that stuff. And then on top of that, I was married previously. And I had two daughters from that marriage. And my two daughters were at the time 5 and 10 years old. And their mother still basically hadn't let go of the fact that we weren't together. And so she used the kids as her pawns to basically drive me and my fiance and my immediate family completely stressed us out, you know, crazy. It was stressed us out because she would tell the girls to do stuff and they would do it when they come to my home. You know, in Houston, they would come visit me every other weekend during the football season. And when I'm trying to, you know, go to practice or go to my game, you know, when I come home to a whole bunch of drama during the football season, during the summer when I had them. That was my visitation time, was the summer months. So the summer was just, you know, between moving down to get used to Houston, but then also now finding out when I come home, my youngest daughter is fighting kids at summer day camp and, you know, telling kids that, you know, other crazy things about me that wasn't true. And it's like every day was something new. On top of all that, I was just trying to be a professional football player and, you know, be a dad.
That's a lot of stuff that people didn't know back then or what that was going on in your life.
Nobody knew that. I didn't, you know, because I wasn't one to tell people that stuff because it was my business. And then also,
yeah, I get you on that, but it still pulls you down as a sports guy. And
exactly.
Anything like I love my kid to death and I got a second one on the way. But even now when my girlfriend's pregnant, I notice that some moments when I want to do something or stream or whatever, sometimes I'm held back because my girlfriend's not feeling good or, you know, or she's not feeling good and reacts that to me because she's a Latina, you know. and I mean, everything influences you around you, you know. If your head is clear, if you have nothing of a distraction around you, you're totally a different person, I think. And it's really hard to zoom out from all that kind of stress situations around, you know.
Exactly. I mean, because like even my teammates kind of noticed. And I remember after those 2 years I was in Houston, and I went back to Green Bay for my final season, and then I retired. I remember running into some of my former teammates from the Texans, and we have a conversation. And then they were like, man, you know, I told them the story, what happened. I told them what I just told you two. And they're like, man, that makes sense, man, because it was sometimes I would see you walking in the hallway, and you would walk right past me, and I would say hello to you, and you didn't say nothing. I'm like, yeah, man, because I wasn't in the right headspace. I mean, if you say hello, and I didn't say nothing, that means I was thinking about all the other stuff going on in my head because it was going on in my life at that time. So it wasn't me ignoring you. It was me, you know, trying to deal with what was going on and trying to play football. And they're just like, wow. They're like, man, I'm sorry, because a few of the guys that, you know, didn't know me, they were treating me like I was one of them players that thought I was better than everybody. And I was like, I'm not one of those players. I was one of those players that I was going to be the best teammate I could be. You know, if you needed me to do something on the field or off the field, you know, you needed me to come pick you up, you know, from, you know, to bring you into practice. If you need a ride, I was one of those guys. You could call me up and say, Amon, hey, I need a little help. Can you come pick me up for this? Or can you help me with this at this event? I'm like, yeah, I'm down. You're my teammate. So I was not the person and I was not the athlete that I should have been like I was in Green Bay. And I apologize. And really, really during that season, I remember I had a few interviews that I did. And I apologize to the Houston fan base because I just, you know, was hurt. And, you know, at that time, like, I didn't say why, you know, how the other stuff that was going on. And some people found out later that my dad had passed away during that year. So they felt they tried to relate on that. But some people, you know, like my head coach, Kubiak, when I found out, when I told him some things that was going on with me, I kind of opened the door a little bit. And I said to him, yeah, you know, he asked me, what's going on? You know, you're showing up late to meetings. You're not being the person I thought you were, or the player I thought you were. I said, well, you know, I got this going on. My dad is sick. You know, my daughters are doing this to me and my fiance and this, that, and the other. And when I said my dad was sick, he kind of just said, well, my dad's sick too. So what's the problem? And I'm like, what?
Oh, I'm man.
Like, wow. He just gave me, when he said that, I pretty much was like, I want to get out of here. I need to go.
Yeah,
I got to get out of here.
Your time in Houston was done.
It was done. But that wasn't the worst, though. That wasn't, you would think that was the worst comment I heard, but it wasn't. I say right after that, not too far after what Kubiak said to me, Rick Smith says to me, he pulls me into a meeting before they put me on IR. I had played two games on that knee, and I played two games. I rushed for one game against the Carolina Panthers. I rushed for 80 yards and a touchdown on a bad knee. And then the next game, I think I rushed for another 90 yards or something. No touchdown. But, you know, almost over 100, almost 200 yards in two games, you know, on a bad knee. And it was terrible. And so Rick Smith calls me into his office because, like I said, I was struggling with a lot of stuff. So I go in and he calls me and I'm like, all right, let's see what's going on. I go to the facility and they say, Amon, you know, Rick want to talk to you in his office. So I go up to his office upstairs and I walk in, you know, and he's sitting at his desk. I sit down at the chair that he has in front of his desk and he's like posturing. He's like fidgeting around. He's like, he looks to me real nervous, you know, about what a question, you know, something he wants to ask me. And he's fidgeting back and forth. He's just doing all these little things. And I'm like, what's up with dude? You know, what's wrong? What's he got on his mind? And then finally he settles and he's like, he started talking to me, you know, how you doing, Amon? I'm like, I'm doing good. I wish I was better and this, that. And then he finally gets to his point, to his question, and he says to me, are you faking your injury? I said, what?
Oh, my God.
I said, you know what? This is verbatim. I'm going to say exactly what I said to him. I said, you know what? If it wasn't for the way I was raised by my mom and dad, I would reach across this table and knock you the fuck out. Nobody ever asked me that I ever, you know, faked an injury. If I'm hurt, I'm hurt. And I walked out and I called my agent as soon as I had my cell phone in my pocket. Soon I pulled it out just as I got out of his room. I called my agent. I said, get me the hell up out of Houston right now because I'm about to kill somebody. And he's like, whoa, 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 Amon, what's going on? I was like, Rick Smith just asked me if I was faking my injury. And he said, what? I'm like, yes, I am not stuttering. Rick Smith just asked me if I'm faking my injury right now. And I hung up and I walked to the locker room and I think I left that day and I didn't come back because I was like breathing fire. I was like, I never play sports to cheat anybody, especially myself or any of my teammates, any of my coaches. And this was the most humiliated I felt, but I don't get hurt. I'm the type of person when somebody hurts me, I don't cry. I don't, you know, go cower in a corner. I get angry. Because I knew the dedication I put in. I knew the hard work I put in. I sacrificed time away from friends and family, you know, doing things with my kids, doing things with my brothers, doing things with my nephews and nieces that I decided to go work out. I decided to, you know, watch more film, you know, study up on my game, get better and be the best at my job. And then to him ask me that, I was just like, I didn't know what it, I mean, I said what I said and I left because I know if I would have stayed in there much longer, it would not have been pretty for him. It would not have been good.
I mean, that's like questioning someone's manhood right there in a minute.
Basically.
You know? I mean, it's not like you've been in the league for like a year. You know, you're a veteran NFL running back playing at the highest level. And then someone asks you that. I mean, kudos to you for not slapping the shit out of them. I don't know if I could have done it, but
I don't know how I didn't. I'll be honest. I don't know how I did not touch that man, but I didn't.
Maybe if you were like 6 years younger, it would have been different, you know.
Possibly. I'll be honest.
I think it's kind of a testament to how your parents raised you too. You know, you say it with your chest and then,
yeah,
you know, a man of action on the field, you know, I don't know.
Oh. So, yeah, after those two conversations, one with Gary Kubiak, my head coach, and then one with Rick Smith, I was just basically on another planet for the rest of that season. I was just not, I was definitely not myself. Because when I got home, I told my fiance what happened. She was like, she was crying. She was hurt. She was upset too. And I'm like telling her, don't cry. This guy doesn't understand me. He doesn't know me. He doesn't care about me. I'm like, so that's why I'm like, don't feel bad for him. You know, don't feel bad for anybody, you know, for other than us, because we're in this situation. You know, I just, for me, I was just so angry. It took me a while to get past that, you know, because I never had anybody that was a part of the team that I was on question me, question my par work, question my gameplay. And so it took me a while to get past that. That scarred me mentally. Because then I saw people in a different, I don't communicate certain things to a lot of people for certain reasons. And so that made me even a little bit more tighter with the information I share with folks that were close to me. And even ones that weren't close to me, I mean, I had a tighter grip on not, I say, opening up to them, because then I saw what I saw. It showed me, you know, not that, I kind of looked at everybody like that, unfortunately, just for a little while, for about 2 or 3 years, where I didn't really trust people because I think they were looking at me, you know, they looked at me as a celebrity athlete that didn't care about nobody, that didn't care about anybody but myself, when that was just the opposite. And so I was like, okay, I've been put in this other category that I know I'm not. And so I got to be careful who I talk to, how I present myself, because they're judging me. And I was just like, wow. I said, unfortunate, this is not good. I said, people who deal with this on a daily, you know, I see why some people maybe go and do things that are uncharacteristic, you know, go into depression, go into, you know, suicidal thoughts and all that, because it was something that I know that I didn't present to myself in other times. In other years, I've been with the Green Bay and all, Green Bay Packers, Seattle Seahawks, Nebraska Cornhuskers, the people that knew me, those people knew me way differently than obviously those people in Houston knew me. So it was just like, oh, it was an eye opener for me. And when
was this your first year or your second year?
First year. This is the first year there.
You were there 2 years, so you had to go back after that season to the same team with the same coach and everything, or what?
Yeah, and it was, and this was
and
the part.
Well, you were I heard you talking about I don't know what amount again, but it was pretty high amount of money that you made there. But in the end, that money is worth nothing if you're not feeling well, right?
Yeah, and it's nothing because I didn't get it all. That's what people don't realize. NFL players,
oh, really?
You know, we don't get paid our full contracts sometimes. And this was one of those moments where I didn't get paid, even though the contract says $24 million, I signed it. It's not guaranteed. The only thing guaranteed was the signing bonus. So I got that. And then after the first season, they wanted me to pay part of that back, the Houston Texans, because I was injured. And I was like, no, I'm not. I said, fire me. And they never fired me because I had the better, you know, I had a right to what I said, you know, say what I said. And then I told my agent, I said, get me out of here. At that moment when I had that conversation with Rick Smith. And then later at the end, you know, when the season ended, I said, let me go back to Green Bay. You know, I'll go back to Green Bay and be a backup. I said, this is not worth it. I said, the way they treat people down here in Houston, players down here, is terrible. And as I talked to other players that were either in the Texans before me or after, and they said the same exact thing. And it's still going on now. You know, you saw what happened with O'Brien and DeAndre Hopkins, the reason why he became a Cardinal. You know, you saw, you know, now J.J. Watt wants out of there. You know, he wants to get out of there and, you know, play on a team that understands winning or whatever he's put it out there, because the players, the coaching staff and the administration that runs that team, they just don't get it, you know. And
so not only are you going through, like, I'll play it, say, plain and simple, you're going through this bullshit as a veteran NFL, a successful NFL veteran running back. You like you said, you listen to your body, and I'm sure at some point in time you're like, I've stayed the course. It's time to sit back. So I'm guessing at some point in time you realize that if you get back to Green Bay, that's it. I'm done. So, I mean, what is that like? I mean, when you realize that you've had such a successful career that
right,
it's time to just be. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's tough for me to even ask that question because I've never been in that position.
No, it's not.
So, I mean, you know what I'm saying?
For me, it's not tough. Yeah.
Being on that level, the highest level, a level that not many people, football players, get to and play as long as you did to realize, you know what? It's time. So, I mean, what was that decision like? You see what I'm saying? Like, in your mind, you're like, it's time.
Yeah, I mean, so that's a legit question. I'm not afraid of that question because in my head, like, from the time I got playing, I started playing Division I college football, I knew there was going to be a beginning, and I knew there was going to be an end, because all the professional role models that I followed, Bo Jackson, Walter Payton, Michael Jordan, Ken Griffey Jr., all those guys that I followed, Steve Largent, Jerry Rice, I knew, I watched their careers start and I watched their careers end. Some of them ended, you know, ideally, you know, where they won a Super Bowl or they got the MVP or they did something fantastic at the end of their career. And then sometimes, like Bo Jackson, you know, his career ended short with an injury. So I knew my career was going to end one of those two ways. It was going to be really, really good or somewhere in the middle or really, really bad. It was going to be one of those three areas.
That's how my soccer career ended, with an injury.
Oh, right.
And the only thing I can tell you about it, I couldn't do any sports because I still cannot do sports with running and jumping. That's forbidden for me because I got a big cartilage injury in my ankle from a dumbass that hit me really hard. And I just had signed my first semi-professional contract. So that was really painful. And I couldn't watch soccer for a long time. I was so upset.
Well,
and even now watching it, like, I feel like I want to play it, but in my mind, I know I can't play it, you know? Because if I tried, like, one time there was this American guy doing like really hard trainings to get fit and, you know, to lose weight and all that stuff. And I started doing it and I had to do jumping jacks, and I was doing 3 days in a row, jumping jacks and other stuff. After 3 days, I was limping. I couldn't stand on my foot anymore. And again, and I was then 28, and I realized, like, damn, it's really over my sports. You know, I used to play tennis with my dad. I couldn't play tennis with my dad anymore. The only things I could do was like snowboarding or something, like when my ankle was stuck in a boot, or swimming or cycling. That was it. Like, and I used to do so many sports. And so seeing people's career end because of injury, it hurts. I know how much it hurts to them, you know? But like you say, at some point, you know, you're going to have to stop, or it's age or it's whatever, you know?
Yep. But
yeah, continue. I'm sorry.
No,
a really bad.
No, because I think if you.
No, it's all good.
If the way you looked at it.
It almost teared me up, to be honest. So.
Right. Man, hang in there.
I mean, it's. Yeah, get tough, Blaze. Come on. Let's get tough here. And
that's why you, like, call me Diva, right?
Yeah. I think it, now that you hear it from you, is that when you were in Nebraska, you were like, there's the alpha and then there's the omega. And I think, I mean, you in the back of your mind, you got out when you were able to do things, because I think I wish I could justify, I don't know, is because I think there's people in the league that hang on too long and then their bodies are just like in shambles and stuff like that. And, you know, that's a sad case, especially now with, you know, as much the concussions and stuff like that, that are going on, you know? So, I mean, kudos to you. 'Cause I'm sure you had that year that it was time to get out. You were listening to your body. But I think what the biggest thing is that you made it back home to end your career.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what was that like going back to Green Bay and knowing that this was going to be your last year?
It was, well, I didn't know, you know, that's how open-minded I was. I didn't know. I was like, I could get here and rejuvenate my career and play another 3 years, maybe. That's how I always look at things positively. And so when I got the phone call from my agent at the time, he called me, he said that this is after the 08 season. Now we're in 09, you know, off a free agency and all that. And, you know, prior to that, the first offseason I had in 07 going to 08, I said, get me out of here. And then he said, basically, well, you got to pay back money. I said, I'll pay it back. You know, just get me out of here. And that didn't work out. So he got me to stay one more year in 08. So when that 09 year, I was like, no, I am out of here. There's nothing. I'll pay whatever I got to pay to get out of Green Bay or get out of Houston and go back to Green Bay potentially, but because I knew that could, that was just more of an option. It wasn't like guaranteed thing because now it's a free agency time again. So, you know, he did find out though. He said, you know what, Green Bay is interested. I'm like, great. You know, okay, that's one. I say that's one obstacle out the way. At least they're interested. And I said, that's better than nothing. And so I remember after I talked to him, he said it was probably like that was at the start of free agency. So that was March. And then I didn't hear nothing. You know, I talked to him a few times and then Green Bay got back to us again, probably like June, July was like, well, you know, let's see how the season goes. I said, we got you there. You know, we want to pull the trigger, but we're going to wait because they had brought in Ryan Grant the year before that to replace me and a few other backs. They said, we got some young backs. We're going to see how it goes. And then, you know, if an injury happens or something, you know, that we need you, we'll pull the trigger. And I'm like, you know, I got to respect that. At least they're being honest with me. And I'm like, okay, no problem. So that means I got to stay in shape. So I went down to Chicago, not far from where I was living, still in the Green Bay area, to Attack Athletics. And that was Tim Grover was the trainer who trained Michael Jordan and a lot of NBA players, Kobe Bryant, and some NFL players as well. So I went to stay down there like 2 weeks out of the month, or you know, I say for two straight months. And then after that, 2 weeks out of every month to go train with him and his coaches that he had there to help me stay in shape during the regular season. I say during the off season. And then when season started, I was training here on my own. Every now and then I would go down there to train with their trainers. And so it was around late September, early October, where I said, I got another phone call from Green Bay and from my agent saying, you know, this is, you know, getting close. You know, we got a couple guys that are beat up that we might bring you in. And if it does happen, it'll be sometime in October. I said, okay, great. You know, so I just, you know, kept working out, you know, staying, you know, focused there, staying in shape, running and lifting. And then mid-October come and I get another call and they're saying, yeah, we're going to, you know what, we're going to bring you in. We're going to bring you in for a workout first. And because we got Ryan Grant beat up and we have another guy that's a young running back that's beat up. So, you know, let's set the workout for this day. I think it was on a Tuesday. And I was like, all right, cool. So I got there, you know, got my workout in. They liked what they saw. And then the following week from that Tuesday, which was October, probably like almost like October 28th or something like that. I remember 2009. And then sure enough, I was there, you know, getting suited up in the, you know, getting in the locker room, getting my old helmet back because I still had it. And it just finally was like, cool, you know, here we go. I'll say flashback though real quick. It was, I remember having a conversation with the team people, like Mike McCarthy was on the phone call, my agent, and at that time, Ted Thompson, the GM. And I remember Mike McCarthy saying, you know, let's get him on here. He has to break that record. He has to get the all-time leading rusher. Because when my last year in 06, when I ended that season, I was 48 yards or 49 yards away from the Green Bay Packers all-time leading rushing record. And so for him to say that, that just made me feel, you know, obviously felt great. I mean, because he knew, you know, one thing that would probably, you know, solidify my time in Green Bay. And he knew what that meant to the organization and most likely to me, because he knew me at that first year in 06 that I played with him. And I liked him, you know, as a coach. He was very, you know, straightforward. He didn't sugarcoat nothing. He made, you know, it's kind of like my mom and how my dad, mom and dad raised me. They tell you what it is and you either do it or don't do it. You know, you either show up to time at practice or meetings and pay attention and take notes, or you don't, you know, and you got to pay for it. It'd be a punishment. And I could take that. And so when he said what he said, that just kind of, you know, from all what those 2 years I just went through in Houston, it just kind of all went away for that moment. It was like, oh, all right, I'm ready to play some football. I'm ready to go make something happen. You know, I got a guy who definitely understands me and wants to support me and get to that goal. And that only also be, you know, wants me to be a part of his team, you know? So that right there I knew I was going to be a Packer sooner or later after that. And then I knew I was going to be a part of the team, that they were going to actually let me, you know, be a part of that offense. And even though if I was a backup, which I was, I came in, I was a backup to Ryan Grant, which I was okay with, you know, this is football, you know, I understand how things go, you know, and your time, you know, is spent where you eventually you're the guy, you're the starter, you're doing, you know, your job, but then eventually you got to become the backup and you got to learn how to deal with that. And mentally, I knew I could handle that. I could be the backup all day. I came into the league as a special teamer where I played all special teams. So me being somebody's backup to me was nothing. And I thought it was part of the game because I seen some of the other players that I followed you know, like a Michael Jordan when he went to the what is it, the team that he ended up buying, the Wizards, and he wasn't, you know, he
Washington
wasn't
Wizards. I knew that.
He went there. He wasn't the starter. He played a lot, but you know, he wasn't the guy that was once when he was in Chicago, and he knew his role. And then other players too. I seen, you know, Jerry Rice go from other team to team after that. Just, you know, you gotta be a pro, and that's what being a professional is about. When you know when it's not your time, you're not the starter. Do your job as to whatever it is. If it's the backup, you know, first string, second team player, play some special teams, whatever. Be ready to go. And that's how I looked at it. You know, that was my mindset coming into this team, you know, once I got re-signed with the Packers in 2009.
Oh, man. So, 2009 season happens, and you're back home. And then what was it that made you say, I've done it?
Well, I'll say, well, the easy part was I was able to get that record. You know, what Coach McCarthy basically said on the phone had came to truth. I broke the record in the Tampa Bay game we had down there. Even though it was a loss, it was still a little small victory for me and my teammates. You know, for my teammates that were on the field with me then, and for all the teammates that were a part of the Packers organization from 2000 to 2006. You know, it was a team effort. I wouldn't have picked those yards up, you know, without my lineman blocking, my quarterback being a quarterback the way he was, in terms of Brett Favre and Aaron. And then my fullback, my wide receivers picking up blocks downfield or just catching balls, you know, in general, because they were who they were. They were phenomenal wide receivers, Donald Driver, Javon Walken, Robert Ferguson, just to name a few, you know, Greg Jennings. You know, I played with all those guys. And so that's why, to me, that's why I became the all-time leading rusher, because I was around players that understood how to do their job. And I understood how to do my job. So it was – that was – I said, that was it for me. You know, I knew that was it for me. But I knew, you know, the season had to keep going. So I got signed mid-season. I broke that record in probably like week 11 or week 12, maybe 13 or later. And we played three more games after that. And then the season was actually, we went to the playoffs. That was the playoff game. We ended up losing to the Cardinals, where it was like a playoff scoring record, where it was like, I think this game we lost 56 to 52 or something crazy.
Oh, my God. Was that Kurt Warner?
Yeah, Kurt Warner. Okay, yeah. That's when they went to the Super Bowl. The Sling Fest, they played against the Steelers. The Sling Fest. So Packer fans still say that, you know, Aaron on that fumble, he got stripped. He got face masked on the strip, too. He got stripped, and it was a fumble. Then they scored the touchdown to win it in overtime against us. And at that moment, I kind of knew, you know, that was it. You know, when we lost that game, I was like, all right, this is potentially my last NFL game. But I'm going to stay hopeful. You know, I'm going to stay letting the Packers know, like I did this offseason, let them know, look, I'm still in shape. If you need me, I'll come in and I'll do whatever you need me to do. So I kept that two options in my head. But I knew also one thing, going in that locker room after that loss to the Cardinals in Arizona, I looked at that team in the locker room and I didn't see not one guy have his heads down, including my own. Nobody had their head down because they knew that they were just one or two plays away from the next round of playoff. And I told myself, and I told a couple of players, I said, this team's going to the Super Bowl next year. I said that to like three or four people in that locker room. I said it to myself, number one. Then every team, I think I said it to Clay. I said, we're going to be in the Super Bowl next year. Watch this. And I say, he was like, hell yeah. And then somewhere, I can't remember else who I said it to. And I said it to one of the trainers, Brian Eagle. I said, we're going to the Super Bowl next year. Watch. And sure enough, the Packers did. The Packers went to the Super Bowl. I wasn't on the team. You know, my career was over. And, you know, and at that time, like I said, I was ready for that. I understood that. And I was at least I was able to accomplish one more year with them, break the record, the all-time leading rusher record. So I had a little victory, you know, a little solace to my career to get that record. You know, I've done a lot of great things. You know, I'm a full-time pro bowler. I was a two-time All-Pro, and I had a ton of respect among my teammates and the players I played against. I remember running into a few years after that. I was at Super Bowl, and actually the next year, you know, I was in Super Bowl in Dallas. I went to the game as a fan and to support the Packers. And I was at a Super Bowl party, and I ran into Derek Brooks, and he retired obviously a few years before me. And that was the first time I actually had the chance to talk to him, like face to face, no helmet, no shoulder pad. you know, we're in suits, you know, at the Super Bowl party. And he gives me his big old hug and he goes, man, I hated playing against you, dude. I hated it. He said, you were one. He said, you was one running back that I knew I had to bring everything. Cause if I didn't, you were going to beat me every play. And it just that, you know, stuff like that was just, you know, similar to what Mike McCarthy said. We got to get him on this record. And then Derrick Brooks saying that, when Derrick Brooks was a guy that I had 100% respect for because the way he played the game at linebacker. If I played linebacker, I wanted to play it like Derrick Brooks, you know. And for him to say that to me, that I was a running back, that he knew that if I wasn't ready, that I was going to get my butt kicked with Amon. Amon's going to run me over, or he's going to outrun me, or he's going to block me in the picking up the blitz. He's going to, you know, if I'm blitzing, he's going to stop me if I'm not ready. And so that just showed me the respect I had earned from my peers. These guys, you know, Derrick Brooks is a Hall of Fame linebacker. You know, he's in Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton. And for him to say that, you know, that's all what I needed to hear, you know, from him. And every other guy I've ran into since then, they say the same thing. They give me that respect. You know, I hated you, but you made me better, or you made me play the game the right way, because I knew that number 30 in a Green Bay Packer helmet was going to come and play hard and play fair and be a football player. And for people to say that to me, that's what I was looking to do. You know, I was looking to make sure, just like I was playing in the neighborhood with my friends and teammates from Little League and high school, is like, you know, we played, there was a code, you know, you treated each other with respect, but you played hard. You know, if you tackle somebody, you tackle somebody as hard as you can. But at the end of the day, it wasn't about, it wasn't personal. It was all about business. You had to make that tackle. And if you caught them at the right moment where you blew them up, you know what? Yeah, you blew them up. Then you know what? You put your hand out there and help them off the ground and be like, hey man, good hit, man. You got me. I'm coming back, you know, or say, you know, it wasn't about being cocky. It wasn't about showing that person up, making them feel bad. If you do your job, you know, then it is what it is. And you just got to get up, you know, knock the dirt off and get ready for the next play. So it was just cool moments like that, that after my career, you know, I just knew, okay, at times I didn't think I was the best. I thought I had to keep working. And so hearing that sometimes is just like, okay, cool. I did something. You know, a lot of respect was there, from a lot of players. And then, like I said, I was at the Super Bowl in Dallas, and I did an event where it got me into the stadium where I was going to basically it was autograph signing and it was appearance, you know, meet a Super Bowl, meet a player meet an NFL player at the Super Bowl. And from that event, I pretty much, I had my ticket punched to go to the game. And because I asked the people after the event was over, I said, where do I go now? They said, oh, you can basically roam the stadium before the game starts. I'm like, are you kidding me? I'm like, all right, I'll do that. I can stay out of people's way real easy. And so I did. I just kind of milled around. It was people setting up for the game. I mean, this is the game. This is not just a regular season game. This is the Super Bowl. I get to hang out in Dallas Stadium, the new one that was just built prior. And you know, and it's my team, you know, the team I was just with. And yeah, they didn't sign me back, but it was like, you know what? I was ready for that. You know, I this is now the next me getting ready to go into the next step of my life and career is now. So I enjoyed the game as a fan. I had to, at first I was in my seat where I was up high. I could see the big screen. The big screen was ridiculous. Very nice. A lot of money, obviously. And then one of the guys said, Amon, do you want to go down and sit by the players? I'm like, what you mean by the players? Do you want to stand on the sideline? I'm like, why did you even ask me that? I would have did that in the first quarter.
So it was like somebody with a stiff arm and you were down, right?
Right. You know, so I get down there. It's like the end. It's like just out of halftime. And I get down there. So I see the whole second half standing behind my teammates from a year before. You know, I see Clay. I see Aaron. I see Donald. I see Charles. I see Darren Coolidge. You know, some of the O-linemen, Mark Spitz, Jason Spitz, I mean. And I'm not sure if I caught Coach McCarthy's eye, but I know I caught a lot of players' eyes. And even Clay was like, hey, man, what's up? And he came up, gave me a high five. We hugged real quick, a quick little bro hug. And I was like, hey, man, go get him. I said, you know, play hard, win this game right now. And, you know, that's just me being a team player. You know, it wasn't me like, oh, man, I'm not on the team right now. It's like, no, you're there. Do it. Go win it, you know. And Clay had one hell of a game. I know he had a forced fumble, you know, big turnover in the game to, you know, sway the momentum toward the Packers. And they kind of had the momentum the whole game. You know, they ended up winning a close game, but they had a good lead. And it was just crazy that, you know, a year ago I was on that roster, and now I'm sitting behind them watching them win the biggest game of a lot of those guys' career. And it was fantastic, you know, for me. But it was kind of like it came, my career for me came full circle, win or lose, being on the team or not being on the team. It was just like, all right, I'm ready to, you know, I'm ready to go to that next move, whatever I got, whatever I'm going to decide to do for myself and my family.
So before we go to the next move, there's one thing I'm glad that you're here, because there's something special that happens in Lambeau when you score a touchdown, the Lambeau leap. What is that like as a player, where you're literally jumping into the crowd and the faithful in Lambeau are like, you know, on another level? So what is that like? You score like the 98-yard touchdown run.
Mm-hmm.
You score, you bust a Lambeau leap. What is that emotion like when you do that?
It's just awesomeness. You know, I can't really explain it other than that. You just got to be ready for a couple of things, though. Just so you know, you're dealing with Packer fans now. you got to be ready for getting groped. Aggressively. Aggressively. Yeah, very aggressively. And you know, Miller Lite is the beer of choice in the stadium. So you be ready to smell like Miller Lite after your Lambeau leap. So that's the Lambeau leap experience for a Packer player.
Because now you see a lot of other teams are doing it, but obviously we know where it started at. But I can only imagine that, you know, Lambeau's loud when the Pack scores, go Pack go. When they score, and then here comes the guy that just busted a 98-yard touchdown, and you look in that crowd, you're like, here I come, bring it, you know. So I can only imagine that emotion and that, like, it's got to be an electric moment. Like you said, you get pretty much groped aggressively. But it was a way for players. Let's face it, there's sports out there where players will not connect with the crowd. But for you guys – I think that was the one thing as a fan, you know, I wouldn't know what to do if I see, you know, the car wash running after me and jumping into the crowd. I mean, like, what do I do? It's like, but you know, you guys are scoring a lot of touchdowns, so you guys were pretty good and athletic at jumping. So,
yeah, and it was funny. So, like, when I was there, it was just get in the stand however you can. I think when I watched that run, I jumped in the stadium stands, and my butt was hanging out, you know, my body was in the stand. And that's how we, at that time, that was the Lambeau leap. That's how you get it done. That's how you get in there. But now, like, when I came back in 09, and it was Greg Jennings, you got Jordy Nelson, Donald Driver, you got Ryan Grant, a few other guys, John Kuhn. So by 09, they had took Lambeau leaping as, like, the Olympics does diving. Yeah. So they were grading each other, like, when from a 0 to 10.0 scale of Lambeau leaping. I was like, hold up. I was in the locker room, like, what are y'all doing? He's like, man, that was more like a 5.5. That wasn't a 6.6. I said, are you talking about how he jumped in the stands for the Lambeau leap? They're like, yeah. I'm like, I just started laughing. I'm like,
try harder.
Right. It's like, now it's like, okay, now you got to perfect jumping into the stadium stand. I was like, so I asked, I think it was Greg I was talking to. I said, all right, so explain to me what gets you a 10.0 Lambeau leap now. He said, okay, when you run, you know, obviously after you score, if you're able to jump on the wall, and as you're jumping, you spin around to be facing the field again. I'm like, oh, I was like, okay, I get it. I'm like, but really, is that really that serious? To me, I was like, whatever. It's like, look, if I just get in the stands, that's how we thought about it when I was here with guys. Because you had guys like Gilbert Brown, you know, Russell Maryland, Leroy Butler. They were like, look, I'm just happy if I just get in there. You know, they're not trying to pirouette up at the top of the wall. That's a 6-foot wall. So that means you got to jump 6 feet first and then spin at the top. I'm like, no. Like, those guys were like, whatever. Now, these new players, it was hilarious. I thought it was hilarious.
The funniest one I ever seen, though, was like Donald Driver. I think it was Donald Driver jumps, spins in midair, puts both his hands back behind his head, and just like lounges back. And I'm like, his feet are crossed. And I was like, okay, this dude's on another level.
I remember that too, and that's when they started handing out the 10.0s or the 5.6s or the 8.8s in a post the next day. It's after they watch film, they're like, "All right, we got an 8.8 on Donald's a jump there." You know, he'll argue it too. 8.8, why? You know what? What was wrong with that? Should have been a 10.8.
You didn't point your toes, so.
You know, you didn't put your toes whatever. You didn't get no Miller Lights spilled down your back, you know. Yeah.
So I think it's funny is that Blaze is like, he doesn't understand this. And, you know, it's like, I finally have one up on Blaze. So
I don't know. I know it's soccer internationally. They got some stadiums that don't even let the fans are like behind a fence, a big fence. So it's not a lot of crowd to player interaction. But it's like when Ronaldo scores or Cristiano scores, he does this big, I don't know what you call it, but where he jumps and then he sits there and he puts his arm, he flexes his arm.
He does his celebration move. Yeah. Like,
yes. Yeah. So his celebration move, it's like that. But just imagine him doing it like on the top of the, next to the fans, you know, fans will lose their mind. You know, that's you know, that's what kind of those moments.
The thing is, when you score a goal or whatever, you know, like I used to play soccer, that was such an explosion. Like, I was a striker, so like I scored 20 to 30 goals a year, which is a good amount. So that's like
great,
an average almost of one goal per game. So once a game, I had this explosion of joy with all my teammates like jumping on top of me, and like when you run a, you know, you run a touchdown and everybody's like happy. And no, that rush, that adrenaline, like I cannot find that in anything anymore, honestly.
Yeah,
like, it's really hard to find the same rush because you're so tired and you're so, you know, you're sweaty and you've been tackled 20 times because in soccer tackling is on your ankles and stuff, which also hurts a lot.
Right.
And I was a big dude because I'm 6'3", you know, so the way they tried to stop me was just by kicking me and tackling me because I used my body to keep the defenders off of the ball, you know?
Right.
But like the explosion of joy is so amazing. And yeah, I always like, we live in Belgium, we have a lot of rain. So usually when I scored, I ran really hard and slided on my knees. Mm-hmm. And, you know, stretched back and then fell on the wet floor and then everybody on top of me. And then you always had one of these amazing teammates that like took mud and put it in your face just to laugh at you, you know.
that sounds like a good Saturday night. So
just that's a lot of fun, man. But so, like, honestly, like I didn't know who you were. So for me, you're just a dude. Like, Junk is a dude to me. Well, Junk is a friend to me, and it's amazing to see always, and it's always confirmed how you're just a guy also, you know what I mean? You have feelings. Yep. I always tell people when they're nervous and everything, when they're going to meet somebody that's maybe more important than them or achieved more or whatever, or when they're gaming and they're playing a last final game against somebody and they need to win, you know, I always tell them, honestly, those dudes, they also pee, they also eat, they also hurt, they also fight with their girlfriends or wives, they also cry, you know. Everybody's a human being. Just, you know, be you and just be as strong as you can. That's always what I say.
Oh, that's a great advice.
So football career's over, and you've been a gamer your whole life.
Yep.
All of a sudden, I mean, what? Obviously, you're what, the director of esports?
Head coach, director. Yep. I manage.
Of 15
esports title. Yep.
Yeah. So was it obviously like an easy transition for you? Because as a player to go, you've been a gamer your whole life, and / NFL stud. Now you're like, you needed to find the next thing. And this is where it kind of comes full circle with, you know, streaming. So you also have your own podcast that you do with some buddies that's out on every podcast platform. And it's called the Amon Green Show, right?
Amon Green's Gamers Lounge.
Yeah, that's what it is. Amon Green's Gamers Lounge. What was it? I'm sorry.
It was the Amon Green Show. The first, like, probably like 2018. It was called the Amon Green Show. You're right.
So you're finding that this is something that you can do, that you can relate to, and that you can be successful in and make, because you, I can only imagine that you're using the same mentality you were as an athlete to make people better. So yes. When did you actually transition into, I mean, I know you did your podcast and you're the esports manager for Lakeland University.
Yes. Coaching started like immediately after football. I would say about a year, 2 years after football. Cause that first year I just went in straight retirement. I basically was home with my wife, my kids and my kids, my stepkids. And basically how I looked at that first year in 2010, 2011, I ended up playing in the UFL actually. So I played one more year, a half a season or a full season in the United Football League, which was a small minor league that the NFL or that the that was created by some organizers. And I played in that one season, which was, you know, me trying to just stay in shape to just in case the Packers bring me back. And so that was prior to that Super Bowl that I watched them play. And so I did that. And that was 2010. And then after that, 2011, you know, I got some feelers out from the CFL that it was an opportunity with the Montreal Alouettes. And so 2011, I do the same thing like I did in 2010 and 2009. I work out, I stay in shape, and the Montreal Alouettes say, hey, we want to sign you. So I signed a 2-year contract with the Alouettes. I'm like, okay, so this will take me to 2013. I'll see where I stand at that time. That's what I'm thinking in my head. And so I drive from Green Bay to Montreal, which was almost a 2-day trip. Almost a day and a half trip, actually. I drove by myself 24 hours, got there in a day. And I get there, have practice. And after the second day of practice, my hamstring got a little sore, just sore. And I iced it. And I was like, no, I'm going to probably just sit out the next couple of days. And so then the next day, they cut me. And I'm like, I was on a 2-year deal. You know, how do you cut me? And then it's like, no, it's like this. It was different how the legalese in the CFL contract. And what I found out later was like, since I was a American player, that they have priority. They give priority to Canadian players. So if somebody's on the wire, like myself, I had a sore hamstring. But that wasn't mean I was out. It just mean I had a sore hamstring. But to them, it was like, no, we need somebody that basically could play. But we still had like 2 weeks before the regular season started. So I knew I was going to be ready to go by then. But to them, they were like, nope, let's get the next person in. So I ended up getting cut. So I'm like, I drove up there. I had my pickup truck full of everything I needed to live in the Montreal area. And now I'm like, all right, I'm driving back. So no big deal. You know, I was like, all right, well, my career football is officially over now. I instantly called my agent and a few other people that I knew that worked in the marketing world. And I said, look, I'm officially done with football. I want to get in, you know, into broadcasting and coaching. And so that's where after that first year where I just was at home, my whole body, being with my family, reconnecting with my wife and kids, going to football games and track events and going to, you know, dance recitals and being a dad again, that was great. And I was playing a lot of video games at that time. I probably beat the most amount of RPG games in a year that I love. I remember walking through playing something with that time, 2009. I think that was Halo ODST around that, or 2010, 11. Halo Reach, I beat that a couple times. And then a game called Crisis 1 and 2, I beat that. So, yeah, I was doing a lot of games. And me and my wife, we were watching. That was the Dexter. That's when Dexter was real popular, the TV show, Dexter.
Man, I love Dexter.
Yeah, we loved it too. We binged it to catch up to season 4 starting up. And so we binged season 1 through 3 when binging became a thing.
There's a new season coming of Dexter, right? I read that somewhere.
I heard they're bringing it back.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, they're bringing it back.
I can't wait. So that was 2011, 2012. And then in 2012, I had the opportunity to coach my stepson in high school football, which was a great feeling. You know, if a stepson or kid, and it doesn't matter, you know, there's somebody that you help raise. Now you get to, you know, coach them in a sport they love. And so it was his senior year, and this is my first time coaching. So I talked to the head coach, and just like, I didn't want nothing. You know, just the way I was and the way I was grown, you know, raised and stuff. It's like, don't give me nothing. Let me earn it. So I did a job interview with him. I brought him my resume, and I didn't just want him to give me the job because I'm a former NFL player or I'm, you know, I'm a father of one of the kids or something. I was like, no, you know, take me through the real, than what you would take through anybody interviewing for a head coaching or a assistant coaching job at the high school level. So we did it that way. And he was like, oh, okay. And then so he asked questions, you know, and we went down the gambit and I had to wait 2 weeks. And then he could, 2 weeks after that, he said, yeah, Mom, I interviewed a few other people and we're gonna give you the job, you know, at running backs coach, help out with linebackers too and help out with special teams. And so that was, for me, you know, getting that first assistant coach job at the high school level was like, all right, this is my journey now through the coaching ranks, because I know it starts at the bottom and get to the top, just like anything else. And so we actually had a fantastic year. So me and my, you know, obviously me and my stepson, we got a little closer, we bonded. And that year we went 10-0 in regular season. We won the conference. It was called the SEC Conference of Wisconsin. And so we were, you know, headed to the playoffs, and we had some big wins during that season. And the first, actually, we went to the playoffs. We beat the first team. I can't remember what the team who we played, but we beat them. And then the second round of playoff, we lost on a Hail Mary to a team that we beat in the regular season. We blew them out at their place, but they just, you know, it was playoff. It was another level of gameplay. And so they beat us on a Hail Mary, like 16-14. So it was like one of them heartbreaking losses. But the season was great. You know, we had three running backs. My stepson was one of the running backs. I got to coach him, and we had two other kids behind him that were all really good athletes that ran the ball as well. And we probably set like two or three, four or five different records in Wisconsin high school football for rushing, because we just ran the ball religiously, which is obviously right up my alley, you know, to coach that up, to be a part of that. And I started to find my footy in the coaching world. So that's where it started, you know, me and coaching. And then as from 2012, 2013, you know, I coached at another high school in the Green Bay area, because Oak Creek High School was actually in Milwaukee, which is an hour and a half drive for me. So I would drive down there three times a week to go coach. And then once my stepson graduated, then it was like, okay, let me find out, you know, let me coach maybe close to home, you know, so I don't have to drive 2.5 hours every other day. So I did. It was a local high school, Southwest Green Bay High School. I ended up going there coaching football and track there in the spring, football in the fall, track in the spring. And I was the assistant sprints coach. And so all the sprinters, the 100, 200, 300 hurdles, even the hurdlers I had as well. And that was fantastic. I coached there for 2 years. And then I also coached at another school that was closer to my house called DePere High School for about a year. And then that brought me to about 2019. I coached at a school, a really smaller school, but a really good school. They're Division III high school by the name of Freedom High School. And I was there for 2 seasons. It was actually one of the coaches that coached up there already. We had other events that we had coached at, little kid football camps. And he remembered, you know, he knew I was coaching and that there might have been opportunity for him to coach with him. He was a quarterback. He played in the NFL for like 10, 15 years. He was actually a career backup. But, you know, backups still make a lot of money. And they gain the same type of experience as the starter does. So he had all that quarterback information that he learned playing in NFL. He played for the Cowboys. He played for the Cardinals. And I think that was it. Played for a few other teams, and he played in the United, the World League, if you remember that league from years ago.
Oh, yeah. I got you.
Yeah, they had the German Frankfurt Galaxy and the Barcelona Dragons, so he played. His name was Chris. His name is Chris Gryson. So he's like, Amon, what are you doing? I said, I'm coaching high school football over at Southwest. He said, you want to come coach with me at Freedom? I'm like, let me think about it. And I thought about it for like a week. And then I was like, you know what? Let's do it. So I came down there and coached it for 2 years. We had fantastic 2 years of football. We went to the playoffs every year. We went deep into the playoffs. I think we missed state championship just twice in both years by one game. So that's how good a talent we had at this small high school in a country town called, you know, country part of Wisconsin, Freedom High School. Freedom, Wisconsin is like, it's basically all farm kids. And I noticed the difference between like a, you know, farm kid, you know, farm kids being raised on the farm to Green Bay or city kids, you know, where they don't understand, you know, what's it like to live on a farm, where you got to basically, you live on a farm to work on the farm, you know, where they wake up, they're, you know, tending to the cows, tending to the pigs, the chickens, the or whatever animals they have on their farm. So I'm coaching kids like that. So they know the one thing farm kids know, they know hard work. So me telling them to do push-ups or run a lap or, you know, we got to do this, we got to do it like this, and we got to do it right every time. They were like, okay, coach, no problem. You know, I'm going to work. I'm going to do it. You know, it was just that. It was just like, wow. I noticed a little different mindset there from that. And not saying it wasn't from the other kids that I coached. It just was, it was like, you know, right away when you say it, they were ready. They were locked in. They were ready to go. They were ready to make you happy as a coach to make sure they did their job right. So then that takes me about 2019. And at the end of 2019, you know, it was like November. And that's when a friend of mine who I would go geek out with, kind of like you and Blaze, we hang out, we talk video games, we talk movies, comic books. And so he's like, Amon, I got the perfect job for you. I'm like, okay, we know you know me very well. So it's either has to do with football or it has to do with video games.
And, got him.
Yep. And so my man Larry says, yep, it has to do with is esports. I said, what? And he's like, yeah, the university that I used to teach at, Lakeland University, they are developing, they're funding right now, fundraising to create an esports program. They had an esports club that some of the students developed on their own, and they would hang out once a month playing, you know, random video games just to hang out. But now they took it, the students got serious and brought it to the administrators. Then administrators took it serious and then started budgeting and fundraising to build out the esports program. And so I was like, I'm all in. I said, give me emails, phone numbers, people I need to talk to right now. And he did the next day. And then pretty much the rest of that is history. I got hired, you know, after the first conversation, and then it was just now me getting to meet, you know, get a tour of the campus and meet some of the students that were already there. It was like, wow, I'm living another dream. You know, it was something, one of my few goals that I have that now that I was always making sure that whatever job I'm doing something that I'm passionate about. Just like I was passionate about football, that now, whatever, if it's coaching, broadcasting, which I do my podcast, I shoutcast tournaments, all that I'm passionate about. So if I could do something in that area, then I'm doing something that I know I'm going to give 110% to. And so when I got hired, and then I start literally the next day recruiting kids for Call of Duty, for Halo, for Madden, for Fortnite, Rocket League, Rainbow Six. It was just like, I can't believe it. I could pinch myself and still couldn't believe I'm recruiting kids to play FIFA. You know, I'm recruiting kids to play League of Legends or something like that. Just like, man, this is awesome. And so that's where I'm at now, is just, you know, reveling in that and just continue to build my players to help them grow, because they were, you know, I was once where they were. So I kind of understand. I know a lot what they're going through being a young college students between the ages of 18 and 24 years old. There's a lot going on in that little short time span for kids that are either in college or not in college, but it's a lot going on. So you got to make sure, you know, I give them information so they continue to grow and develop in the right way.
Yeah. So that's where like me and you have more in common with esports, because I was an esports manager for Apotheon Esports. And I know.
So if you ever need a manager for your school to show people how to not play in Call of Duty, you can hire Chunk. You know, he can show them all the things that they don't need to do.
You know what they say? if you can't do it, you coach, right? So
yeah.
But honestly, he's got this, I'm sorry to put it out there, but he's got this series going on his TikTok called what's it called again? Dying in Verdansk. He's dying all the time, you know.
So y'all be playing a Warzone a lot, huh?
I'm
a Warzone player, yeah.
So it's like, I get what you're saying. It's more taxing, I think, recruiting, looking for the right fit, than anybody really realizes, because, you know, there's so many factors that go along with it. The fact that you're over, said, what, 12 esports programs?
Yeah, we have Call of Duty, we have Madden, Fortnite, Rocket League, League of Legends, Super Smash Bros, Brawlhalla,
FIFA,
Valorant, CSGO, Smite. That's 10 right there. FIFA.
Yeah, FIFA.
That's Elite. That's 11. And then trying to think. I think that's it right there. So 11 games. Call of Duty is 12. Call of Duty is 12, I think.
So, that's kind of, I think this goes to show the progression of esports and content creation is that now you can go to college, get a degree, and play games that could progress, possibly recruit, you know, lead you to something different.
Exactly.
I just think it's really cool. It's a full circle moment and everything Amon Green. Started out playing video games, played on the island, smiled and ran people over. Played a college, NFL, great career. And then you fell back into the gaming. And kudos to you for being that and for sharing your story. Because I think a lot of people don't realize this, you know, like you said, there's some things you never told anybody, but you put it out on this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's really overwhelming. So I can't say thank you enough for giving us more of your time. And like once again, I'm telling you, if Blaze ever slips, you know, I might be ringing. I was like, you got experience. And I was like, you know, Amon.
Why you always try to like?
Because
like, am I not good enough for you anymore?
I'm not saying
what's
anything.
Going on.
So I'm just
putting Amon, if you need a FIFA / Warzone coach, I'm always free. You know, I play both games, so
I would love to have you. I would have love to have you virtually. You know, play up with my players. We have a couple. We have Brett, Joseph. And we just picked up a new player by the name of Juan that all play FIFA right now, and they're in season. So if you do have time during your week to jump in a match and help them out, then I'm all ears. I don't know everything about FIFA.
You're gonna
I know
hear
a little
a guy,
bit.
Yeah, you're going to hear a guy rage in Dutch, you know.
I would love to hear that. I would love to watch.
Actually rage in English always, you know that.
But it's okay.
But once again, thank you for coming back. It means the world. I'm glad that we had the opportunity to tell part two, so you can finish the whole, you know, journey. Your where you started and where you ended now. And for me and Blaze, we wish you the best. And I think the only like I've said it to a lot of people because you can meet there really passionate. But the only thing that's going to stop you from accomplishing your dreams is going to be you, Amon. And I don't think anybody's going to stop you. So. Thank you for coming back.
That.
You're always welcome to come back, and you can coach Blaze on how to be a better teammate.
So, you're always welcome to join me and Junkhead in some Warzone games, so you're going to have the biggest love in your life.
We'll have a good time.
All right, you too.
So, you guys, once again, all Amon's stuff will be down below. Check him out. Show him some support. If you're not following them, shame on you. When you hear this episode,
if you still need a college degree and you're an awesome, super good gamer, contact him. You know,
well,
maybe
I'm sure
that's
not going to be that easy, but you know, who knows? So you guys, yeah, make sure you guys are listening to this podcast. Give us a 5-star rating, thumbs up, tell everybody about it. And thank you again, Amon. It was great hearing your story. And you guys get out there and keep gaming, because if not, Amon's going to be. Number 30 is coming at you, so keep on fragging out. Here we messed it up.
You're messing it up. I wanted to say, Amon, it was awesome meeting you as well. I didn't know anything about you when we started the first podcast, and I admire your life, man. And I just hope you can keep on going and being an example for your own kids and the kids you're, you know, coaching and everything. So just keep on spreading the love to everybody, man.
And I will, Blaze. Thank you.
All right. You guys get out there and keep gaming, because you better be fragging out, because if not,
you'll be lagging like Junkhead just did.
Oh my gosh, here we go.
Mom! 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 Get the camera! I gotta kill! Mom, I gotta kill! Oh yeah, baby! Oh, mommy, I gotta kill! Finally, after 250 games sitting in a corner undying to the gas!